welcome to Escape from Lockdown, the podcast all about how we're going to get out of this damn lockdown with our sanity intact and what its effect is going to have on our lives and the country around us. My first guest, present yourself before us. Name?
Tim Price.
And what is your profession?
Specialist subject. I'm a fund manager, and author.
And what is your sentence?
To be determined, surely, by the outcome of this podcast.
This is an indefinite sentence, house arrest, I'm afraid, like everybody in the country.
Okay.
Sorry about that. So, Tim, can we start by talking a little bit about your area of expertise in general? How have you been finding the lockdown?
So the professional stuff first. So what we do within my business is we look after the assets of wealthy people. Not necessarily super wealthy, but you know, let's say six figure life-saving type levels.
And so I will never ever encounter you professionally.
Not necessarily. We also have a fund. So we have a global value fund, which is managed according to the investment principles of a chap called Ben Graham. And if the name Ben Graham is not familiar to anybody, then I suppose the main way to introduce Ben Graham is he's the guy that taught Warren Buffett. So Ben Graham literally wrote the book on value investing, a book called The Intelligent Investor back in the 1940s. But he's also the guy that taught Warren Buffett basically the principles of value investing at Columbia Business School. And Buffett is the only person, the only student that attended Ben Graham's class who got an A.
Wow.
So the fund that we manage is basically global value investments. What do we mean by value? A value stock is a listed business, the shares of which you can buy effectively at a discount to what you think that company is really worth. Ideally, the management is superb at capital allocation. But the shares themselves are available for whatever reason, basically on the cheap. So a value stock is one that you don't necessarily have to pay too much for, but ideally will do very, very well over the medium to longer term. So, and that's the funding question is a retail fund, so you can invest in that.
Is there going to be a medium to long term anymore?
Well, that's a good question. So Kane said in the long run, we're all dead. But I think, this is the question, I guess, that everybody's asking. How long does the lockdown last? And it's the question that nobody, I think, has a legitimate answer to. But I think, like you, I have some fairly grave reservations about... There's a word I came across a few years back now. Do you know what iatrogenic is?
No, it sounds like a made-up word to me, is it?
No, I think it's Greek, and I don't know Greek either. But an iatrogenic illness is an illness caused by the doctor. So I think that's a fairly good way of describing, you know, the current situation. In other words, we have clearly a global virus circulating at large, but arguably, James Dellingpole has suggested that the coronavirus pandemic might be a bit like or a lot like the Millennium Bug, namely, it was the problems predicted were always overhyped. And one has to now have the suspicion that whatever the severity in terms of the deaths, you know, the tragic deaths that are going to be caused by it, the government response, the mass government response, arguably is going to be even worse than the disease itself. And that's an open question, but I guess we're all experiencing it in real time as we speak.
Well, it seems to me that the longer every day that we go on adds to the iatrogenesis. Mm. Does that work?
Possibly. You need to have the next time. You'll have to have a Greek scholar on, someone like Boris Johnson or something.
Yes, he'd be correcting his Greek right away. I once asked him to count to 10 in Greek for me, but he wasn't brilliant at it. But that's another story. But what worries me is, you know, there seems to be very little debate in the public sphere about actually ending this. There's Peter Hitchens, James Dellingpole, Toby Young, a few others. Every time somebody raises their head above the parapet on this, the slings and arrows that are thrown at them are phenomenal. And it's real venom. And I had an experience of this you know, I'm on Twitter. I'm very addicted to it. I don't tweet that much. I don't have a lot of followers. And I tweeted something about the fact that I quoted a tweet to somebody who was furious that Toby Young had an opinion at all on this issue and was being taken seriously in his Sun article that he wrote. Mm. And I said, look, you know, we've reached a stage where any questioning of this thing is greeted with inquisitional rage. And the hate that I got from that, because the original author, who was a poet or something, it came back at me. And I felt like, I feel like Toby Young is a kind of orbiting chaos elemental, where all the hate of the liberal left gravitates towards him. And if you even go near him, even online, you get caught up in that chaos energy.
That whirlpool, that vortex of horror.
Yes, that would tear the flesh from your bones. And I swear this is true. The rock journalist David Quantick, who appears on those kind of top 10 albums shows and stuff
and
like
that. He's also a comic writer, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Well, I'd say what he said to me wasn't very funny. he said, I didn't say anything to him. He just came in and he said, cockface.
I probably shouldn't be laughing.
Yeah, I know. It bothered me so much. And someone else came after me going, you look at you, big man. And I went on their profile and obviously they're like, talk to me about mental health. Yeah. Be kinder. And but this is the point I'm getting to in a very roundabout way is how in the people I speak to, my family, people I know professionally, the lockdown skepticism is extremely widespread. And people are very much willing to discuss it. And people are extremely worried about the consequences of this. But online or on the media, there's only a few people and it's pure hate headed their way.
Okay, so let's just address the potential costs of this mess. And let's first of all say that, you know, I don't think any government in the world was fully prepared for this. But to be fair, the governments of Southeast Asia had more preparation because they experienced SARS firsthand the last time around. So they, you know, people like South Korea and Singapore had a better handle on this because they've had personal experience in a way that we haven't. But I mean, this is the thing about social media, that all the people that were previously expert on, specifically Twitter, all the people that were previously experts on international trade during the Brexit debate are now mysteriously experts at global epidemiology and virology spread. So
where is, you know, this university amazing that gives out
it's amazing, isn't it?
Trade deals and epidemiology.
I think it might have been you that pointed out that given this multitasking ability, why our productivity figures aren't higher. It's just remarkable, really. So the question
I didn't point that out. Someone else did, and I wish I
know.
I did
if you, you know, if someone's going to throw you one, you might as well claim it regardless. I mean, it's all's fair in love and war. But to get to the issue of the cost. So here's just an FYI, and I've used this one once or twice now. So my brother read economics at Cambridge, and he tells me a story that in his very first tutorial, the Don, who's still teaching actually at Cambridge, basically said the following. He said, between 1929 and 1932, the US economy fell by 10% in the first year, and then it fell by another 10%. And then in the third year of the Great Depression, US GDP fell by another 10%. And then he just paused. And he was expecting, like, sort of shock and awe. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the reality was these students sort of looked at him blank-eyed and going, yeah, and? So he didn't really have the emotional impact that he was expecting. But that's basically the prior example of the most severe recession in the largest economy of the world in history. Just as a starter for 10, the current forecasts for the contraction in just UK GDP in the second quarter are of the order of 35%.
Jesus.
So
Christ.
In the context of one quarter, you're talking of something that's basically broadly comparable, if not worse, than the worst 3-year period in the history of the 1930s depression. So if that doesn't give you the measure of the damage that's already being done, frankly, I don't know what will. You'll know more of this if you know anybody that's personally exposed to the restaurant trade, hotel, leisure, transportation, oil and gas, airlines. I mean, one could go on.
I'm terrified that all those businesses will go, and people don't seem to understand how, you know, it's not a bunch of fat cats, like the sort of Monopoly guy.
I mean, there is going to be bailout money misallocated to the people who don't deserve it. That's also true, sadly.
So our tax money will still go on, be wasted as it was in 2008-09.
I'm hopeful that a few things will change. One of them being that HS2 finally gets kicked into the long grass. Because, I mean, people will say, well, we need infrastructure projects, but actually. No, I'm not sure we do. I'm not sure we do need, you know, super fast railways. I think we have bigger priorities, and the bigger priority is just getting money to the people who've been forced out of work because the government's decided to lock down the economy.
Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, Tim, but this morning the government greenlit HS2 to go into construction. So. Maybe they kind of in for a penny, in for a pound. We've already banked.
Okay, well, if we have to live with HS2, then hopefully we can at least kick Huawei's involvement in 5G into the long grass then, because that one really is going to be a tough sell in this environment and hereafter. But in terms of the playbook to get out of this mess, there's a very good podcast between a guy called Anthony Pompliano and an Indian chap called Chamath. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to attempt his surname, because I would just massacre it. But it's available on YouTube, and I dare say we could put it in the show notes for this recording. And I've just done an edited highlight of this, where this guy Pomp, he's known by, says, "What's your playbook to get us out of this?" And Chamath is Indian billionaire entrepreneur, so he knows a few things. And his answer, and this is the précis of his answer, but it's as follows. So bear in mind, this is the US, but clearly you can adapt to your sort of local environment. Take every single voting site used at the next election, schedule every single man, woman and child to go through those testing facilities, deploy a rapid test to figure out whether they had coronavirus at that moment in time. If you didn't have coronavirus at that moment, you go to a second test and you get administered a finger prick. You get tested for the antibodies. When you're done, you get given a wristband. If you tested positive, you get a red band, you go home and you self-isolate. If you test negative and you have the antibodies, you get a green wristband. If you test negative and you don't have the antibodies, maybe you get a blue one. Green and blue are allowed to go back to work straight away. Red self-isolates, you contact trace, etc., etc. That's the front line of getting the economy back to work. Now, again, I'm not a virologist. I know nothing about medicine or healthcare or anything else. Or rather, I know as much as the next person on Twitter. But the point being is taking that at face value and assuming there will at some point be reliable tests for both the coronavirus and for the antibodies, then that seems to me like a plausible place to get to in the fullness of time. And we could do the same thing with relation to our own polling stations, provided there's the kit to deploy. But clearly, I mean, every government with means around the world is rushing to get this stuff done. So what I'm not convinced of is the fact that we're going to get a vaccine to this, to the extent, and I'm not being bearish, it's simply my understanding is that, I mean, COVID-19 is being called a novel coronavirus. We've never successfully managed to secure a vaccine to any of the previous ones. So I don't see why this one necessarily is going to be any different. It's just that the previous ones, like the common cold, we've developed a sort of a modus operandi of living with them over hundreds of thousands of years. So we've come to an accommodation, and we will come to an accommodation with this one in the fullness of time. But we're experiencing it brand new, whether or not it's a Chinese engineered bioweapon.
I'm not sure it's a bioweapon exactly, but I wouldn't.
Whether it was designed and engineered or not, that's the practical outcome, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is effectively a weapon that has spread around the world. So whether or not that was a deliberate ploy is somewhat academic now, because the damage has already been done.
Well, there was a certain amount of discussion whether this would be their Chernobyl.
I think it is. Well, the problem is that it will be.
But it's their Chernobyl in the sense that, you know, when the reactor exploded over Ukraine, they had to deal with the damage. It's as if the reactor exploded over the Ukraine, but all the damage happened in all the other countries
everywhere
far away.
Else. So they had a big umbrella and everyone else got the fallout, yeah.
Exactly. And now the Chinese, they're kind of back to work, aren't they? And
well, you get that. Yeah, I mean, one hears that they're back to work, but I wouldn't trust a news flow from China as fast as I could flush it down the toilet. So I'm not really the world's biggest China sympathizer here.
No, well, I mean, I think it's worth going into the fact that, you know, there's an element where we were told, oh, this was clearly the wet market. And everybody kind of thinks, oh, yes, it must be the wet market because I learned about that in the news and therefore it's correct. But there is this virus lab a few hundred meters away from this market.
280 meters away, apparently.
And the particular type of bat, which is a horseshoe bat,
intermediate horseshoe bat, I think you'll find.
An intermediate. Oh, I didn't know that. Not a beginner's horseshoe bat.
Yeah, exactly. It's got its advanced Duke of Edinburgh's award.
Yeah, it's very much still training for its DOV, this intermediate bat. But they don't roost within 900 miles of Wuhan, and they're also not sold in this market. And it seems to me it's a case of, can't you people keep anything locked up? It's obvious that somebody dropped the vial and they tried to cover it up. And then when the researchers and doctors started sounding alarm about this, what did the Chinese do? They harassed them and they intimidated them and they tried to shut them up.
So this is from the blog HarvardToTheBigHouse.com, and it's as at 14th of February 2020. A probable smoking preprint has been released by the National Natural Science Foundation of China. Quote, in summary, somebody was entangled with the evolution of 2019 nCoV coronavirus. In addition to origins of natural recombination in intermediate host, the killer coronavirus probably originated from a laboratory in Wuhan, unquote. And then it goes on to say, in a predictable turn, that article has been removed and both researchers have since deleted their profiles off the ResearchGate site completely. Furthering the appearance of a cover-up, back on January the 2nd, the Wuhan Institute of Virology's director sent out a memo forbidding discussion of an unknown pneumonia in Wuhan after ordering the destruction of all related lab materials a day earlier, making it abundantly clear that the Chinese government knew about this outbreak long before they took any steps to contain it or made any public announcement. So when I see crap like the Amnesty International ad on Twitter saying, calling it the Chinese virus is racist, I think, well, actually, it's accurate and truthful.
Well, I think we should go further and say the Chinese Communist Party virus.
Well, Chinese Communist Party sponsored virus. Yeah, Chinese Communist Party plague. I think all of these are acceptable.
Well, the plague brought to you by the Chinese Communist Party.
Yes, exactly. Facilitated by those people at the CCP.
There's a fascinating article that I think I sent you last night in the Washington Post, that well-known tin hat for conspiracy newspaper, which says, it's amazing, 2 years ago, State Department officials were so concerned about this particular research facility and the fact that it was grafting bat protein onto coronaviruses.
They stopped funding it.
Yeah, and they said, this is really, we should really have a look at this, could be bad. And what do you know, 2 years later, a bat protein novel coronavirus comes over out of Wuhan. And yes, oh, it was the wet market. That's what it was.
Yeah, someone had bat on toast and then mysteriously it spread around the world. Or somebody at a lab... basically, and what the Harvard to the Big House site suggests is that safety standards are so lax in these places anyway that it could easily have been an accidental release, or for that matter, someone could just have sold a lab thing from the lab, maybe even in that wet market. But either way, the whole thing just stinks.
It's a question: do you think after they're done with the specimens in the lab, they just sell off the excess in the wet market?
Yeah, yeah. Well, but who knows? Who knows?
I mean, the thing is,
we'll never know, probably for sure, not least because the Chinese will never allow us to know. But
no, they've already been.
What I would like to think is that there is some kind of international investigation, and let's just say if the meter's already running, then I don't know what the sort of cumulative reparations cost is, but it'll be running into the, you know, probably the tens of trillions of dollars, and I'm not sure even the Chinese have got that much money.
No, but I worry that our governments are just still completely unable to stand up to the Chinese. And except, I mean, there is this one glimmer, which was Donald Trump last night and closed funding or halted funding rather for the World Health Organization. And specifically, I think it was a kind of sideways swipe at China, because I pulled up his statement now. I'll try and not do his accent, but it's just a gloriously Trumpian statement, completely trolling everybody and promoting his own genius at the same time.
He gives good troll. I mean, let's be honest.
Oh, well, listen to this. One of the most dangerous and costly decisions from the WHO was its disastrous decision to impose travel restrictions from China and other nations. They were very opposed to what we did. Fortunately, I was not convinced and suspended travel from China, saving untold numbers of lives. Thousands and thousands of people would have died. There he is. I just think it's great that there we have our leader who's willing to stand up and say that. And sort of say, yeah, you know, those guys were assholes. And if it wasn't for me, it would be so much worse. And already the articles are coming out in the media saying, oh, this is him trying to deflect away from his own failings. Well, the United States isn't actually doing considerably worse than most other countries in terms of their rates of infection or death.
This is absolutely fair. And what you touch on or what you open up is the sort of Pandora's box of, you know, modern mainstream media journalism is just now is proving itself hour by hour and day by day utterly unfit for purpose. So if you want a sort of classic example of this, you see the number of people from the left of the, you know, political spectrum gleefully writing and saying and tweeting the most appalling things in relation to, you know, our prime minister. I think the most notorious one that I've seen to date was the post from only the Europe editor of the effing Economist saying, oh, I can't believe this is really the guy who was allegedly at death's door. This all looks mightily suspicious to me, mightily fishy. I'm thinking, just get in the sea.
Yeah, it casts a huge... it's an incredible disservice to all the doctors and nurses that are supposedly caring for him.
They're just part of a conspiracy against the public.
So basically, the Europe editor of The Economist thinks about Louis from Porto, you know, fuck him. Fuck that guy. he's a lying bastard. Like, what's the Europe editor of The Economist name?
I don't know, because I blocked him as soon as I...
Isn't it Lockwood or something?
Yes, is it Christopher Lockwood?
Chris Lockwood, maybe. Yeah. So, Chris, if you're listening to this, some of the newspapers found that nurse's family in Portugal and spoke to his family. Why don't you do a shit in a box and post it to that nurse's family and scrawl on it in your own shit, why did you raise such a lying bastard as a son? Fuck you.
So, moving on. We're faced with, you know, the same shtick happening again and again and again on our TV screens every evening, and it's a painful experience. And I think, you know, I mean, I earn nothing from Twitter. I have no links with the company whatsoever, but it strikes me that Twitter is, you know, if you choose selectively from the, you know, the whole world of information and commentary that's on there, you can get a far better service from some informed source on Twitter than you'll ever get from the mainstream media.
100%. As someone who works within the mainstream media, I'm quite shocked at how kind of unable a lot of the people who work in it are. and how so much they take their opinions and their views from the people around them. Many years ago, I was an assistant in the lobby, which is what we call the press corps in Britain. And it always struck me how I didn't. I want to make clear: I did no writing. I did nothing of any value while I was there. I was just basically sharing the office space. But I was always struck by how the lobby journalists would sort of agree on the line of the story with each other first, before putting out their copy, and even the way they discussed things, like anybody who wanted to leave the European Union, for instance, was a loony. You know, these things were just said openly. And like you say, when we have genuine transnational complicated issues, the media has shown itself completely unfit for purpose. And one of the huge problems is that they look at everything through the prism of their own political biases as well, and their own narratives. So the media is hung up on issues like PPE and testing, whereas actually, in the grand scheme of things, are they really that important?
Well, it's not just that, but also the NHS is. I don't know how many billion is poured into the gaping maw of the NHS each year, but the NHS employs people to procure material. So I don't really see why. I mean, clearly the minister. The Secretary of State for Health has an obligation, it has an accountability here. But I don't see why the government is accountable for decisions that should be being made by the people, the hundreds of bureaucrats employed by the NHS up and down the land, to be buying this stuff themselves.
Well, it's also Public Health England as well, who I think are responsible for testing. And in normal times, they can't get enough publicity. Because of
we're all eating too much sugar and salt and smoking and drinking.
Yeah, and then when something does come along that could actually kill a lot of people, it utter silence. And you know, I can see why. I mean, if your organisation is in charge of doing the testing, and that's the thing that people are targeting, obviously he's not going to want to put himself in front of one of those remote press conferences.
I mean, I think all we're seeing realistically is the fact that there's no crisis so big that the government can't make it worse.
So going back to the media as well, I mean, what other things have you noticed? I mean, and this is being, a sort of 10-year-long decline anyway in the quality
the scales started to fall from my eyes around the topic of Brexit. So And I think I speak for a lot of people in the world of finance that the most disappointing trend has been the long but steady decline in quality of the two most previously celebrated journals in our country, namely the Financial Times and the Economist. So the Financial Times and the Economist were both rabidly pro-EU. And so I would look at my own situation. So I'm 50. I'm a fund manager. I have my own fund management business. I live in London. In what respect do I not represent a core demographic for the readership of both of those publications? But the reality is I feel every time I've been reading either of them over the last few years, like I'm in a minority of one. And I just wonder how both publications got captured by the what I'd call the loony left. It's
and
bizarre.
And also, it's an act of ultimate, a sort of, suicide by a thousand cuts, because in that way does not lie financial success.
You wouldn't think so. I mean, the person who highlighted some of this stuff to me is an economist who I think actually is not even in the country anymore. I think he's in Switzerland. But he introduced me to the phrase "the long march through the institutions," and this is the problem. It's not just limited to the media. This leftish bias. Suffuses really all parts of the establishment. So it suffuses the BBC, it suffuses Westminster coverage, it suffuses the CBI, and it suffuses all parts of higher education. And it's baffling. And it also reminds me of a line I heard about academics a few years ago, which is the question was, why are academics so bitchy? And the answer, because the stakes are so low. Which I quite liked. I'm not sure it's necessarily relevant to this, but I thought it was a good line, so I thought I'd lob it in there anyway.
It's a great line. It reminds me of a police officer talking about the amounts of money that people get murdered for. And he said in movies, people get killed for like, you know, $500,000 on the table or like a big bank job. And he said the lowest amount of money he'd seen someone killed for was 50 cents. Yeah. So the stakes are so low.
Yeah.
That's why it's so violent. At the okay, so I think we've sort of touched on the media and the sort of the bane on the world economy that China has become, despite providing us with all these lovely cheap goods. Now, we're going to go through some of my items that I've prepared. So, the first one, what's in your stockpile, Tim?
What have I been stocking up on? I've been strategically procuring £5 notes. Because you can't get them out of cash points anymore. I haven't been able to for years. And because I'm, let's say, a reasonable user of Deliveroo, who I think has had a great crisis to date, I typically tip the Deliveroo person a fiver when they arrive. So fivers have been extremely important to me. And so that's what I'm currently hoarding.
Well, Tim, once this crisis is over, I will take you to the Tesco's cash machine on Roman Road.
They don't do fivers, do they?
They do
fivers. Oh, my Lord.
I think maybe you're in sort of, you're around Hampstead or something like that.
We're south of Hampstead, yeah, Belsize Park.
I think you need to go to the wrong side of the tracks, Tim.
Okay, maybe I'll live on the wild side, walk on the wild side.
It's a wonderful feeling getting sort of 40 quid out of fivers because you think you're a billionaire again for one. You just sort of fan yourself with the money.
Loads of money.
Do you know where that character came from, by the way?
I thought he was a plasterer.
He was a plasterer, but Harry Enfield got the idea because he saw, he was going through an airport or a train station and he saw the Chelsea fans waving all their money at the Newcastle fans.
Right.
Yeah, we're really rich. And he thought, oh, there's something in that. And that's what that character has sort of defined a generation in many ways. It always gets looked upon. It's probably on television for no more than, 20 minutes in total, if that?
Yeah.
Okay, so, another one I've come up with, contraband. I want to keep the prison, in this podcast, I want to keep the prison theme going for hilarity reasons. What's a non-essential item activity that you've really been enjoying during this lockdown? Is there anything... Now, don't incriminate yourself.
No, I won't incriminate myself. I would say it's a PC game, a free PC game called War Thunder
that I
discovered just before Christmas. So I originally went online looking for a tank battle game because I haven't played a good tank battle game for a while. And that War Thunder offers that, but what actually it offers is there's an aviation angle to it, so you can basically have dogfights against dozens of people and dozens of planes, and it's absolutely terrific. As someone who was sort of reared on the ZX Spectrum in 1982 with somewhat boxy graphics and a little sound device that simply went beep, this is things have come a long way. And so at War Thunder in the dogfight scenario, so I've basically been assiduously building up a squadron of Spitfires, the highest ranking one being an F Mark 9 with a Vickers cannon, and I have to say it's mightily fun, basically shooting the Bosch out of the sky on a daily basis.
I would love that. That sounds absolutely. It's awkward for me because my partner is German.
Okay, but you don't necessarily need to shoot at the Bosch. You can shoot at the Kraut. Sorry, I was going to say the Kraut. Basically, all human life is there. So they've got, and I'm going to go off on one now because it's reminding me of that Douglas Bader joke, which I'm sure you've heard. With Douglas Bader, the guy who's played by Kenneth Moore in Reach for the Sky, who had lost his legs, but went on to continue flying as a pilot. And so Douglas Bader's giving this talk at a girls' school. And so the headmistress introduces him as this sort of great war hero. So he starts and he goes into his routine. He says, well, it's just past midday. And all of a sudden, these two fuckers came out of me at the corner of the, and the all the assembled teachers on the dais start looking to each other, some alarm. And he goes, and then a few more fuckers came at me. And one of them immediately stands up and interrupts and say, girls, I should just probably just add that, fuckers are a type of German, you know, a military aircraft. And Bardo goes, yes, that's true, but these fuckers had Messerschmitts.
Oh, I remember getting in trouble for saying fucker, and making the assumption at the science museum, I think, or when I was about 8. That joke, that memory still came back to haunt me.
But knowing War Thunder, they've got basically every type. I mean, so I'm finding it also very educational. I'm learning, genuinely learning quite a lot about tactics, but also the various military aircraft of various regimes. Because you don't, I mean, obviously, as a true Brit, I'm playing with Spitz, and I had a Hurricane at one point. But you can take any country you like. So for example, if you go to the Japanese version, you can fly Zeros, for example.
I wouldn't trust anybody who doesn't play as Britain in a war game. It just seems a bit wrong to me.
I completely agree.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I'm like that with football games. So I just feel the need to just play as England. It feels like an act of betrayal to go with somebody else. So actually, that just leads me on to something, because if you talk about the education, one thing that I've really been enjoying this lockdown is a podcast called We Have Ways of Making You Talk.
Yep.
Which is the comedian Al Murray in his normal persona, who's a massive World War II nerd, and James Holland, who's Tom Holland's brother, who's also a historian, but just about World War II. And there's about 100 of these, and I've only got through a few, and they're absolutely fantastic. And they just talk about all these amazing little bits about World War II that you never knew about. And it's really fascinating, really addictive. I'd really give that a recommend.
Oh, I'll have to look that one up. Are you familiar with Jeff Norcott's podcast?
Yes, that's one of the ones I do listen to. It's a goodie.
Because I was really disappointed. So our company, as a team, we went up to the Edinburgh Fringe last year to sample some of the local fare, and we had the Jeff Norcott routine. The Jeff Norcott gig was probably the best thing that we saw. It's extremely enjoyable. And so I'm mortified to find out that, of course, Edinburgh has been cancelled for this year, which is a terrible shame. But Jeff Norcott, for people who don't know him, is sort of right-leaning but well-meaning. And he's the perfect antidote to all these boring lefties banging on about, you know, Brexit and everything else, because he's just the voice of slightly right-of-centre middle England. And it's rather wonderful to hear him. And he's very, very good.
He's a very nice man as well, Jeff. And it's a kind of antidote in the sense that we can't complain too much that the media is sort of dominated by left voices, because he has been able to get in there and make a space for himself.
But he occupies a niche of, I dare say, one. He's pretty unique.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And there's something ever so sort of tokenistic about it.
How could we be lefties when we've got Jeff on, you know?
Yes. And Jeff is he's very sound in his thinking, but he's not exactly combative, is he? He's not.
I don't know. I mean, I think I to be fair, as I see and hear him, he's a stand-up comedian first and a politician and polemicist second. So everything's, when I listen to him, and I think it's called What Most People Think is his podcast. Yeah. Every time I listen to him, I get the idea that I get the sense that, you know, he's after the joke, and, you know, he's serious about what he's saying, but, you know, the joke kind of comes first. The punchline comes first. And I also get the sense that podcast is heavily, if not totally, unscripted. So he's got an amazing talent.
And the music is extremely good on that.
Well, this is the other thing that really amuses me. So I was listening to it in the bath this morning, and he's got a new version, which is a sort of lockdown edition. And for lockdown edition, he goes beep 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 beep, and it's just so quaint and wonderfully inappropriate. It's like, you know, someone just tiptoeing or sort of, you know, whistling past the graveyard you know, with a little like a little Sinclair ZX Spectrum beep accompaniment. It's really rather charming.
I'll have to listen to the last episode. I haven't caught it up yet. Actually, that also leads well to what I've called the watch list, which is basically a format that I've nicked from your show, State of the Markets. So you'll be very familiar with it.
There's nothing new under the sun.
Although, to be fair, it's not recommending films and telly to people isn't a completely original idea.
No, I think people have been doing it for a while.
Yeah, they have. So, I mean, I suppose so in a way, we're creating our own water cooler moment in this. So, would you recommend for us any films or TV to be watching in the watch list during this lockdown?
Films, TV, what would I go for? One thing we're hoarding, because we're keeping it on the TiVo, is I think it's just called it's Friday Night Dinner. We must be up the fourth series now, which is basically just a Jewish family meeting for their Friday night dinner. And so I haven't seen the latest series yet, but all of the previous ones have been absolutely superb. So we must be up to about episode 4 now, I'm thinking. So we've probably got, you know, a good solid evening's worth of binging. But I've been resistant to doing it, so we can binge later. But Friday night dinner's superb.
Oh, well, I think I caught the first series of that. I didn't realise that it carried on.
I think we're up to like series 3 or 4 by now.
Oh, terrific. Okay. Oh, that means more fun to watch. I'm going to recommend to you something, and it's absolutely fantastic. It's called Quiz, and it's everywhere at the moment. And it's a dramatisation of the 2001 Who Wants to Be a Millionaire cheating scandal.
Oh, fabulous.
And it's just glorious. So Michael Sheen plays Chris Tarrant.
Yeah.
And Matthew McFadden, who is in Succession, who's the sort of man who marries into the family, he plays Major Charles Ingram. And
that case is currently on appeal, isn't it?
Is it?
I think it is. I seem to remember seeing a headline about it this morning. So I think I think his original sentence is being appealed.
Well, the structure of the miniseries is quite clever, because it sort of starts with the trial and then you go back.
Yeah.
And then you actually go all the way back to how the show came to be and how it got developed. And so someone who works in it is really, I'm sort of really fascinated by that kind of stuff as well. And there's all this stuff, all these people, they built fastest finger first machines in their garages in order to practice on them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and yeah, like you said, there is this kind of suggestion that, you know, maybe he didn't do it. You know, there's a lot of people coughing then, and, you know, maybe he genuinely wanted it. But what was fascinating was last night someone pointed out how Major Charles Ingram is on Twitter. And let me do this as a test. What do you think he's like on Twitter? Where do you think he swings in the kind of in the culture wars? Let's say.
I would hate to suggest. I wouldn't have a clue.
Well, he is a massive FBPE tinfoil hat.
Oh, no.
Carol Cadwallader retweeting.
Oh, no. Mad,
Boris
mad,
the
mad
Butcher.
As a box of cats.
Oh God. It's just, and so any suggestion that I thought where he was actually an honest broker and was mercilessly caught up in this, I'd have to say no, he did it.
Those bitches be crazy.
Yeah, he's and also something that people don't really know that well much either is that he was also convicted of insurance fraud afterwards.
Oh, the
in a
plot
completely
thickens.
Separate. Yeah, in a completely separate thing. So. What can I say? You know, the people.
There's so many smoking guns out there at the moment. It's amazing how anybody's able to breathe at all, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a difficult world, and certain behaviours lead to others, and it all gets very depressing. So, what are we on? Just about 50 minutes. I think we've kind of. I've really enjoyed this, Tim. Thanks so much for being my first guest.
Pleasure.
I feel like. In many ways, I feel like we barely touched on anything, really. It's been, but I think it's been a great podcast, and thank you so much. So at this point, I have to say thank you, and to our audience of maybe about 4 or 5 people. Bye.
Bye.